This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. In the 1980s, leveraged corporate buyouts by private equity firms saw high returns for investors and were considered by many the solution to corporate wastefulness and mismanagement. Since the year 2000, nearly 11,500 companies with almost 8 million employees have been purchased by private equity firms. But as their role in the economy has increased, Eileen Applebaum, an economist, says private equity has come under fire from labor unions and community advocates who argue that the rise of leveraged buyouts has destroyed jobs, caused wages to stagnate, burdens otherwise healthy companies with debt, and leads to taxpayer subsidies. Currently, there are nearly 2,800 private equity firms in the U.S. Today on the program, Eileen Applebaum, who has published extensively on a variety of economic policy topics involving labor and employment, discusses her most recent book, Private Equity at Work: When Wall Street Manages Main Street. Her book scrutinizes the largely hidden operations of private equity firms, which she argues disproportionately benefit the partners in private equity firms at the expense of other stakeholders and taxpayers. Eileen Applebaum is a senior research economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Her talk at the Hinckley Institute of Politics was co-sponsored by the Department of Economics at the University of Utah. She spoke on March 28, 2014.
I'm really grateful to the Graduate Student Association for making this possible. I'm very pleased to be here, and what a great audience we have today. So this is a book that I wrote with Rosemary Bott. We began working on it 4 years ago. Books don't just materialize, so not related to the presidential campaign or anything like that, but related rather to our deep interest and concern about what happens in companies. And we come at this topic really from the point of view of what are the outcomes for the sustainability of organizations, what are the outcomes for workers and other stakeholders. And you'll see as I talk, it's not just workers who are involved. There are the creditors who make the loans to these companies. There are the vendors who supply them with goods and services. And there are the communities in which they are located and where they may be mainstays for consumers and for jobs. So we're interested in the outcomes for all of the stakeholders, shareholders included, but not exclusively shareholders. So the book is just out. As you heard, I have picked up a copy, arrived in my office almost as I was leaving to come here to Utah. And it will be available in stores in May, but it can be ordered on Amazon.com at any time. We're interested in private equity as opposed to other things we've looked at like work organization or work and family policies because we're trying to understand the impact that this form of financing of organizations and governance structures has for all of the stakeholders in a company. And one of the main points of our book, of our research, which we did not know when we went into it, but which became clear as we studied this industry, is that private equity is a financial intermediary. It's a financial firm, like a mutual fund, or a hedge fund, or a stock brokerage, or a bank. It's a financial firm. But what we discovered is that unlike those other kinds of financial firms, it is not a passive investor. A mutual fund buys shares of stock. It hopes that it bought them in the right companies. It hopes it's making money for the people who have invested with it. But it does not come in and take over the company, replace the top management, organize the work, pick out the business strategy, decide who's going to be on the board of directors, all of the things that we discovered that private equity does, and which means that private equity it manages these companies. It doesn't only invest in them. And yet, legally, it is treated as if it were an investor. So this creates problems in that it's exempt from various kinds of labor laws. It's exempt from various laws governing pensions. It has very special treatment in the tax code that no corporation has, and we'll talk about all of those differences. So P is an active manager, not just an investor, and it's large and powerful. That's another reason for wanting to take a look at it. These numbers apply to the decade from 2000, from 2000 to 2012. The 2,797 PE firms are headquartered in the U.S. That's true in 2012. The 17,744 U.S. companies that they took over, that is in the period from 2000 to 2007. And over that period of time, 7.5 million workers were employed by private equity-owned companies. Now, one of the big differences between private equity and publicly traded companies is that managers in publicly traded companies hope that the company will continue to employ them and will continue to exist into the future. Private equity buys a company with the goal of selling it in 3 to 5 years. So it's very interested in what happens during that 3 to 5 years. But if it leaves the company in a position where 7 or 10 years later it might have problems, that's not its problem. It only is concerned about being able to exit, make a profit in a 3 to 5 year period. And at the end of my talk, if I don't run out of time, I will try to offer some policy prescriptions, which are geared to curbing the excesses. As I go through the talk, I will talk about situations in which private equity can play a valuable role in the economy, and I'll give you some examples of that. But much of what it does is excessive, in my view, and the policy proposals that we have are to reduce the incentives for private equity to take on unreasonable amounts of risk. So we will try to answer the question, what is private equity? How does it make money? How is it different from public corporations? And what can we do to make sure that it continues to exist but is not excessively risky? So there are competing claims about what private equity is, and I can give you two examples that you might be interested in. One is Adel Sausages. If you lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, you would know this company very well. It's an iconic company. The guy who owned it was a chemist and a foodie, and he invented chicken and apple sausage. And his are the best. They're really good. They taste great. And he has a whole line of these. And it was a family-owned business. And the thing about a family-owned business is, all right, the family has all of its wealth tied up in that company. If it's growing at 3% a year, that's good enough for the family. They don't want to take any chances. They don't want any losses. And so while it was iconic in the San Francisco Bay Area, and while the managers in the company could see possibilities for expansion nationally, the owners, the family that owned the company, were unwilling to take any risks. Well, this was a situation where private equity came in, helped them become a national company. And they caught my eye, and the reason that we decided to study them is that their employment went from 140 to 350 employees over a three-year period. So we wanted to know, what did you do to make that happen? And they were sold to Sara Lee in 2011. They were bought for $34 million, 40% debt, and sold to Sara Lee for $87 million a few years later. This was a very nice investment for that company. No negative effects on employment. Sara Lee took that company as a center of excellence, kept the existing management, kept it intact. But of course, Sara Lee has huge distribution networks, so the company has been very successful. A second example, also from California, also an iconic company, Mervyn's Department Stores. It was acquired in 2004 by Sun Capital and a bunch of other private equity firms, but it was the lead firm with two-thirds debt, one-third equity. Within a year, they took on an additional $400 million of debt. So they paid $1.2 billion for it, $800 million in debt, $400 million in equity. And then they had the company take out more loans for $400 million, and they used the loans to pay themselves back, the private equity owners. So now they are more than whole. If I have time to tell the whole story here, they are more than whole. When it was acquired, it had 280 stores, 30,000 employees. The private equity firm sold off the assets. That's the other part of the story. So, you know, stores have physical structures, and then they have the business. It separated the company into two companies. I'll talk about this later, but a PropCo company, which owned the property, and an OpCo company, which operated the stores, and the stores now have to pay rent. The operating company has to pay rent for the stores in order to be able to conduct its business. And when they sold off that property, the money, none of the money went to Mervyn's. All of the money went to the shareholders, to the private equity firm that owned it. This is different than other sale-leaseback operations. You can imagine a company that needs cash now and says, okay, we're going to sell this building, we're going to have the cash infusion, and we're going to lease it back. That could make sense in certain circumstances. But then the company gets the money from the sale. In this case, the private equity guys got the money from the sale, and the company got the rent that they had to pay for leasing back the stores. So actually, even before that $400 million additional loan that they took to pay themselves dividends, they had already made all their money back on the sale of the property. Not surprisingly, within a few years, this company is bankrupt. And when it goes bankrupt, its liabilities has $64 million in liabilities, and this is less than the $84 million increase in its rent due to the fact that it had to lease back. So if it had not had to lease back, it would not have been bankrupt. Over the 4 years, 30,000 workers lost their jobs. So this is kind of the two faces of private equity, and we want to understand how is it that one private equity model can lead to such very different outcomes. So the private equity firms, when you look at them and you want to understand how they make money, you have to look at them at three levels. There is the private equity firm itself. It's at the top. It's usually a partnership. And everything is geared to funnel money up to the partnership. That's what private equity firms are about. They're about making money for the partners in the private equity firm. Now, you have a private equity firm, and what it does is it goes out and it recruits investors. And it recruits investors for what is called a private equity fund. And the investors are wealthy individuals, foundations, sovereign wealth funds, but the biggest investors in private equity are unions and public pension funds. 35% of the capital that flows into private equity funds comes from pension funds, from workers' capital. So now we have the fund, and the people who have invested in it, they are called limited partners. And one of the partners from the private equity firm, or sometimes a team of partners from the private equity firm, becomes the general partner of the fund. So you have a private equity fund, it has a general partner who comes from the private equity firm, and it has a bunch of limited partners who put up the money. The private equity firm, or the partner, the general partner from that firm, puts in $1 to $2 for every $100 that the limited partners put in. So it puts in very little, $1 to $2 for every $100 the limited partners put in. Now, the private equity funds are what go out and buy companies. The firm does not directly buy companies. The private equity fund goes looking for target companies. And despite what George Will said about distressed investing, that's a very small piece of what private equity does. It's actually one of the positive things that it does, but it's about 2% of private equity investing. What private equity really does, think about it, they want to sell the company in 3 to 5 years. So you want a healthy company. They go out and they buy companies in which employment is expanding, in which productivity is good, and generally speaking, these companies pay above average wages. So it's buying companies where wages are good, productivity is good, and employment is growing. So it now buys these companies, and the general partner makes all of the decisions. The limited partners commit the funds. They commit it for 10 years. They can't take their money out. No new people can add money once the fund closes. And the money is committed for 10 years, and you have no say as a limited partner in what happens. So, for example, CalSTRS, which is the big pension fund for the California teachers, is in a fund that owns the company that produced the guns that killed the kids, the little kids in Newtown. CalSTRS wants out of that investment. They want the fund, which is owned by Cerebus, to divest of that particular investment. Well, okay, they'll divest, but you know, only if they can get the price they want for it. So far they haven't divested, and there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that CalSTRS can do about that. They are in a fund, they have a contract, they've made a commitment, They have to give the money that they committed whenever the fund calls on it, and they can't say where it's invested or what happens to it. Okay, so that's the limited partners. The general partners make all the decisions about how much debt to use when they buy the company.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Eileen Applebaum is an economist who recently published a book that examines private equity firms and their impacts on labor, wages, and the economy. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, economist Eileen Applebaum spoke at the University of Utah this past March about her recent book, Private Equity at Work: When Wall Street Manages Main Street. Applebaum's book examines case studies from the past decade and considers whether private equity firms are financial innovators that save failing businesses, or rather, financial predators that bankrupt otherwise healthy companies and destroy jobs. She documents that while private equity firms have had positive effects on the operations and growth of small and mid-sized companies and have turned around failing companies, she finds that the interventions of private equity most often lead to significantly negative consequences for many businesses and workers.
Now comes the most shocking part of my talk. How does private equity buy a company? Well, you're used to the idea that they put a little down payment, like you buy a house, you put a little down payment, and you have a lot of debt. This is like you bought your neighbor's house, you put a little down payment, and your neighbor has to pay off the mortgage. When they buy a company, they use the assets of the company as collateral for the loan. And it's the company, not the private equity firm or the private equity fund, that has to pay off that loan. This is really, I've had people say, can this really happen in America? But yes, that is the business model. So that means that if a particular company in their portfolio, and these are referred to as portfolio companies, they buy these companies for their portfolio, the way you might buy stock for your portfolio, right? They buy companies for their portfolio. The amazing thing is that if the company goes bankrupt, the costs of the bankruptcy are borne by the company, not by the shareholders, who are the limited partners and the general partner in the fund, and not by the private equity firm. And in fact, every transaction is structured as a separate corporation so that there can be no spillovers from one to the other. We have the example of private equity buying up real estate. They bought up rent-controlled properties in Manhattan, famous rent-controlled properties. And their idea was they were going to turn these into condos. They were going to evict the people who live there, turn them into condos, and make a fortune. Well, it turned out that they couldn't get the tenants to leave. The tenants fought back. They didn't leave fast enough. They couldn't convert them fast enough, and they couldn't meet the payments on their debt. And the whole operation went bankrupt. The creditors are out there. Hundreds of creditors have bought mortgage-backed securities, big commercial mortgage-backed securities for these properties. The private equity firm just walked away from it. Okay, so whatever little bit of equity they put into it, they now lost it. It wasn't even the rounding error in their 10-year returns. It cost them nothing, basically. A couple of groups, limited partners, did lose money on this deal. CalPERS lost money. The Church of England lost money. There were some people who lost money. But basically, the private equity firm is not responsible, even though they were wealthy, wealthy private equity firms and could have taken care of the problem. They overcharged on the rents. It was found against them. The tenants who were overcharged are still waiting to get their money back. So in any case, what we see is that the bankruptcy costs fall on, in that case, they fell on tenants, they often fall on workers, they fell on the creditors. What are those mortgage-backed securities worth today? Lots of people suffered, but not the private equity firm. The other thing that we can see, if we think about private equity, is other ways that they make money that are not available to publicly traded companies. If you're a publicly traded company and you have subsidiaries, headquarters provides services. Decides on buying IT or figures out what kind of IT you need, provides you with advisory services, provides you with monitoring, monitors your accounting. That's just what happens because you're part of the company. But private equity firms, directly, the firms now, not the funds, the private equity firms directly charge their portfolio companies for these services. They may share some of the fees that they get with the limited partners, or they may not. But they can charge for all kinds of advisory services. If they decide to add on a company to an existing, they have one portfolio company and they want to expand it by merging it with another company, all those transactions costs have to be paid by the original company. They are not paid by the private equity firm. And those costs are paid to the private equity firm to reimburse them for any cost that they had and whatever profit they want to make on it. So you can see that the money is constantly flowing up to the private equity firm from all of these arrangements. So the next thing I want to talk about is how private equity makes money. And there are several different approaches to making money. I want to stop for a minute just to point out for those of you who may not have taken a course in economics, the difference between profit-seeking and rent-seeking behavior. Profit-seeking behavior, the owners of a company come in and try to grow the company. They are trying to make the economic pie bigger. And as the economic pie gets bigger, the slice going to shareholders will obviously get bigger along with the pie, but so will the slice going to workers and creditors and other stakeholders in the company. So profit-seeking behavior seeks to grow the economic pie. Rent-seeking behavior seeks to grow the slice of the shareholders at the expense of the other stakeholders. So they're not growing the pie, but they want to make sure their slice grows anyway. So that's the difference between profit-seeking and rent-seeking. So the first way that companies make money is through private equity firms can come in, especially to small and medium-sized companies, and help them develop better business strategies and better operating procedures. So small and medium-sized companies may not be set to benefit from growth in an industry. So one example, and this is still speculative, we have to see if it pays off for private equity, but in advance of Obamacare becoming the law of the land, but after we knew that it was going to happen, they bought up lots of hospitals. Their idea was that they could help these hospitals be situated for the growth that they thought was coming as so many more people were going to have health insurance. The government now required certain kinds of record keeping that you needed health IT services for, and they felt that they could bring this to the hospitals, and as the industry expanded, they would be set to grow with the industry. Well, that's a good thing. Private equity bought Detroit Medical. Considering the state of Detroit, I don't know who else was going to buy Detroit Medical and give it any chance at all of serving the population of Detroit. I hope it works out the way they planned, and I hope it works out well for them. You can make operational improvements. So we already saw the Adel's sausage situation. In that case, what they did is they didn't improve the way that the sausages were made, but what they did do is put people on the board of directors who knew about national marketing. And also, the private equity firm that took over is focused. It's a specialized firm focused on the food industry. So as demand expanded, it knew how to increase production. Well, this was very important. It provided operational improvements. That was a little company. Axel Tech, which is a major supplier of parts, not just for automobiles, but for military vehicles, that type of thing. And it also was much better situated by a private equity firm to be able to take advantage of the growth in militarization that we're watching all around us, but they're benefiting. And that was another example. Positioning a company for rapid growth. There was an entrepreneur who had a very interesting idea for how you could coordinate what went on in a hospital. One of the things that happens is that emergency rooms get overcrowded because rooms on the floor in the appropriate departments have not been prepared, and people cannot be moved out of the emergency room into the department of the hospital where they belong. So you have overcrowding in the emergency rooms and all kinds of horrible things that happen to people. a company named Awerix came up with an interesting way to be able to signal throughout the hospital, where are the wheelchairs that you need? Where are the gurneys that you need? Which rooms have to be cleaned first based on who just showed up in the emergency room? Great. And it was a little company. The entrepreneur is a great entrepreneur, but he didn't know much about growing companies. It was installed in one or two hospitals when private equity came in, and very quickly they had it in 18 hospitals and had the company geared for growth and were able to sell it at a nice profit, and another good example. And then we do have this thin sliver of distressed investing, which is also very important. So we wouldn't have a steel industry today, an integrated steel industry, if it were not for Wilbur Ross, who at a time when the steel industry was on its back in 2003, many steel companies that actually shut down their furnaces, which if you know anything about steel, they never do because it's so difficult to start them up again, and nobody would take a chance on them. He came in, he worked with them, he met with Leo Gerard, who headed up the steelworkers. He said, I know how to make money, you know how to make steel, I think we could work together. And there are some bittersweet aspects of this story. I don't have time to tell you all of it. But in the end, we have an integrated steel industry. And in a short while, he was able to sell this integrated steel group that he put together to a family named Mittal, about which the steelworkers told us everybody in that family knows how to make steel. If a plant's in trouble, he sends his wife to run it. So that was an interesting side point. Arcelor, which is the big integrated steel company in Europe, thought it was going to take over Mittal. We do now have ArcelorMittal, but I have to tell you, Mittal took over Arcelor. So these folks know what they're doing. Anyway, we do have these good examples, is what I'm saying. Certainly private equity can play a positive role in the economy. However, a lot of what goes on in private equity is just financial engineering. By the way, that was profit-seeking examples. These are rent-seeking examples. Financial engineering basically means finding ways financially to transfer resources and wealth from other people to yourself. And this is what the PE funds have done. The transfers from portfolio companies. So dividend recapitalization, I already talked about it in the Mervyn's case. They bought the company with a certain amount of debt, and then they required the company to pay them a dividend. If the company has sufficient cash flow, they'll take the dividend out of the cash flow. If the company doesn't have sufficient cash flow, they will require the company to sell issue more bonds, usually junk bonds at this point, because they already have $800 million in debt. So they issue junk bonds and use that money to pay a dividend to the limited partners and the general partner in the fund. This is called a dividend recapitalization, when they sell the junk bonds in order to do this, load themselves up with more debt. So that is just, those are resources that the company should have had to invest in itself, in its processes, in its marketing, in its IT, whatever it needed. But instead, it had to issue junk bonds and give the money to the shareholders. The second is the OpCo-PropCo model. And this is when they take over in retail or restaurants or golf courses or nursing homes, anything with a lot of real estate. They immediately divide the company in two, an operating company and a property company, and as soon as they can, they hold on to it usually for a year for tax reasons, but as soon as they can, they sell it, the real estate, to a real estate investment trust. They've taken their money out. Now, if the company makes it and does well and gets sold on the stock market or something else, they make more money, and if not, they already made their money. They don't really care that much. So that's another transfer from the portfolio company. A company that never had to pay rent now has to pay rent, and the benefit of all this has gone to the private equity fund. Transfers from workers, these I think you may be familiar with. As I mentioned, they take over companies that typically had increasing employment and paid above average wages, and they demand wage concessions. This is definitely true when they take over unionized companies. They say, well, you know, your wages are out of line with the market. Yes, that's what unions do. They get higher wages for their workers. And the private equity company will say, well, we're not going to take you over. We're not prepared to pay those wages, so we'll have to have the concessions. And then the other thing that they do is that they lay off workers. This often speeds up the work and leads to work intensification. So that's another way that they take it, transfer from the workers. We have transfers from taxpayers. So a typical publicly traded company has 30% debt and 70% equity. Ordinary stockholders, like you will be someday when you have enough money to buy stock, ordinary stockholders are risk averse. The probability that you are going to invest in a company that has 70% debt and all the dangers that that poses to a company are not very great. So publicly traded companies typically have a debt level not higher than 30% of the value of the enterprise. Private equity stands this on its head. It typically has 70% debt and 30% equity. Okay, that being the case, it gets a huge tax advantage because debt, the interest on debt, you get to deduct from your tax liabilities, whereas the dividends that you pay out to shareholders on equity are counted as profit and you have to pay taxes on it. So there's a huge decline in the tax burden of a company that is taken over by private equity simply because of the high debt burden. That decline in taxes that you have to pay, all by itself, without doing anything to increase the productivity of the enterprise or anything else, raises the price of the company because it now has greater cash flow than it had before. So this is really, you take it from the taxpayers and you realize it both in the short run as you're not making those tax payments, and when you go to sell it, the company is worth more.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Stay with us. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today, we're airing a talk by Eileen Applebaum, a senior research economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. She's written a new book, Private Equity at Work: When Wall Street Manages Main Street, that scrutinizes how private equity firms have done good things and some not-so-good things for American communities and the economy. Her talk now continues on the subject of tax arbitrage.
So, for example, a lot of these companies that they buy are headquartered in the Cayman Islands. So they pay taxes in the Cayman Islands, but they don't pay any taxes in the U.S. Other kinds of tax arbitrage, they're big. A little company can't afford this, but a big private equity firm can hire people who used to work for IRS and say, okay, we're putting you in our tax accounting department. They have tax accounting departments in these big companies, and it's true of GM and General Electric and other companies as well. These are profit centers. These are not just people who are filling out forms and making sure they're done right. These are people who are milking every little loophole they can find in order to be able to maximize the profit for the company. So we have a lot of tax arbitrage that goes on. And then there are transfers from creditors. So you are one of the people who put up the money for that 70% debt. You loaned them the money. You might be a bank or you might be a wealthy individual. You might be a mutual fund. You might be a hedge fund. You've put up this money. Now the company looks like it might go bankrupt. Well, it's standing on the edge of bankruptcy. And the private equity firm says to you, well, you hold a lot of our debt. If we go into bankruptcy, who knows what you'll be able to get? So we have a proposition for you. We'll buy our debt back at 50 cents on the dollar. So creditors take a haircut in that situation. If they think the company is in danger, they will be willing to do that. The other thing that these companies do is what's called a debt exchange. Okay, you're holding all of our debt. The payment is due next week. Actually, we don't have the money for the payment, but we have a proposition for you. What we're going to do is we are going to propose that we amend the agreement that we have with you. And what you're going to do is you're going to, in the new agreement, you're going to reduce the amount of debt that we owe you, because we can't possibly pay off the amount of debt that we owe you. We're going to extend the time that we have to pay it off, and we'll offer you a higher interest rate. Well, that's another deal that, you know, you own this debt, that's due next week. They say, we don't have the money, we're about to default, but here's an idea. We could amend and extend. And that's a debt exchange. You exchange the debt you're holding now for debt that will be due in the future on a lower amount of debt at a higher interest rate. It's, you know, sometimes the best deal you can get. So this is financial engineering, and this is a big part of what goes on. And then we have the situation, which is not so common, but which does happen, in which private equity makes money by reneging on implicit contracts and sometimes on actual contracts. So in any business, there are implicit agreements, things that people have always understood are going to be done in a certain way. They don't always maximize shareholder returns in the short run. Generally speaking, they have a long-run positive effect. But you can, if you're only in this for 3 years, you can quickly increase your bottom line by reneging on these. So Mervyn's is my, you know, a key example of everything that could go wrong. And in fact, was sued by the vendors. The workers have no standing to sue, but the vendors, who are unsecured creditors, had standing to sue and got the biggest settlement that has ever been made to vendors in a situation like this from Mervyn's. But Mervyn's was guilty of everything. So Mervyn's headquarters were in Hayward, California. That was its headquarters, and it felt like it ought to do something for the community, and if it did that, that people would want to shop at Mervyn's. That was their view of it. And so they gave the store manager $100,000 a year to spend on community projects. They built a playground for the schoolyard. They renovated the library and bought it books. They run a summer lunch program for the kids in the community who would have gotten lunch at school during the school year and have no place else to go. They did all kinds of things and endeared themselves indeed to the community. Private equity comes in and says, well, we don't need to do that. They left them with $10,000 to do community good, but that was $90,000 straight to the bottom line. Now, what effect did it have on the community? You can imagine, but they weren't worried about that. So that's an example of breach of trust with stakeholders who are not employees, but who are your customers. There were many other examples of breach of trust. You can imagine if they were willing to renege on that, what else they would be willing to renege on. Another kind of example of this is bankruptcy for profit. And Sun Capital has had several bankruptcies that run the following way. The purpose of bankruptcy is that, okay, you couldn't run the company very well, we're going to give you protection from your creditors, but you're going to lose all your equity. You are not going to be able to own this company. When a company goes bankrupt, the owners of the company do not own it after the bankruptcy. That's the general way things work. But Sun has found a way to take companies into bankruptcy, have another unit of Sun, which provides financing, provide debtor in possession financing, it's called. So keep the company running while it's in bankruptcy and while you're looking for a buyer. Provide them with a loan that gets them through that. And then have yet another unit of the company buy the company. So this is what happened with Friendly's. Friendly's, if you're not from the East Coast, you won't have heard of it, but it's a famous ice cream chain on the East Coast. Everybody goes there for ice cream. They bought it up. The Friendly's workers were so excited. They knew that their menu was outdated. They knew that their stores needed to be refurbished. They were so happy the private equity was coming in. They thought all kinds of good things were going to happen. But instead, the company went bankrupt, and a unit of Sun Capital provided it with financing to get through the bankruptcy. And I didn't make the point before, but private equity firms typically have more than one fund. They float a new fund every 3 to 5 years, so they typically have 2 to 3 funds operating at any time. So a second private equity fund of Friendly's, of Sun Capital, came and bought the Friendly's. So in the end, it got rid of a lot of its debt. It got rid of all of its obligations for its workers' pensions and for its retirees. And in the end, it still owned Friendly's without the debt, without the pension liabilities. How did it do that? And it bought it for the amount of money it lent it to get through the bankruptcy. No additional money changed hands. I don't know how it did it, but it did. So that's what we mean by bankruptcy for profit. Well, I see that I'm running out of time, so I'm going to not go through this very much. I will just say that if we go back to the original Adels versus Mervyn's, what we see is that Adels was a small company, and small companies do not have much that you can mortgage. So it was 40% debt. You could never get 70% debt on a little company like Adels. It didn't have enough assets. And because it was a little company, family-owned, there was a lot of room for improvement. Little companies often don't have sophisticated IT systems, they don't have good accounting systems, they don't have professional management, they don't know how to do distribution. You can come into a small company as a private equity firm, if that's what your goal is, and improve it. And we have many examples in the book of that. Large companies, on the other hand, those that have enterprise value of $500 million or more, already have done all those things. They have professional management, they have professional accounting, they already have a good IT system, they know how to distribute their product. All you have left to you is financial engineering. And that's what happens. They come in, and that's what happened to Mervyn's. It was the victim of every kind of financial engineering that I put up, that I mentioned and put out for you to think about it. And so that was, of course, the reason that it had those problems. So I only have a few minutes left, so let me just focus on the following. Debt is the lifeblood of the private equity model. All that debt, because debt magnifies returns. Think about it. If you buy a house for $500,000 and the house costs $500,000 and you put 20% down, you put $100,000 down. And now, over the next year, the house goes up in value by $100,000. It's now worth $600,000. That's a 20% increase in the price of the house, but it's a 100% increase in your return. You put up $100,000. And now it's worth $100,000 more. That's $100,000. That's 100% return for you. Debt magnifies the returns from successful investments. However, debt also increases the risk of financial distress, bankruptcy, and even liquidation. So, debt is the link between the private equity model at the level of the fund and the portfolio company, which is loaded up with debt, and the payoff for the private equity partners and the firm. We have in this situation where the returns go to the firm and the risk rests with the company and its stakeholders, what economists call moral hazard. I want to go back to the point I made earlier that private equity partners put in $1 to $2 for every $100 that the limited partners put in, and typically they put in 30% equity and 70% debt. In that case, they have at most 0.6% of the purchase price at risk. Private equity company has put in 0.6% of the purchase price. Another big chunk was put in by the limited partners. And the biggest chunk of all was put in by the creditors. The creditors get a fixed return, whatever interest rate is being paid, and doesn't matter how successful the company is, they don't get any more than that. And when we look at the earnings from a successful exit from one of these investments, comes back to the private equity fund, the private equity partners get 20% of that. They put in 1% to 2%, they get 20%. And for arcane reasons that we do not seem to be able to do anything about, they call this return carried interest, and it is taxed at the lower capital gains rate. Now, when a real estate developer has a property, develops it, and then sells whatever they've built there to customers, to people who want to buy it, they earn money the same way, but they have to pay. If it's a corporation, they pay the corporate income tax, which is about 35%. If it's an individual and they're in the top income brackets, they also pay 35%. If it's a partnership, then you pay it as an individual, and they also pay 35%. But the private equity partners, they pay 20%, which is the capital gains rate, much less than is paid by a corporation or a partnership around real estate. And yet, what did they do? They bought these companies with the idea of reselling them at a higher price and making a profit. How is that different from what the real estate developer did? Yet we give them a special tax preference. So not only do they make 20%, but it's taxed at a low rate. So this gives them tremendous incentive. They have very little to lose. If they've overloaded a company with debt and it goes under, they have very little to lose. On the other hand, if they exited successfully, they have everything to gain. This is what is meant by moral hazard. They're the decision makers about how much debt the company has to have. And they bear none of the downside, virtually none of the downside risk, and a huge disproportionate share of the upside gains. That's what economists call moral hazard, and moral hazard is well known to lead to risky behavior. You're going to take risks in that situation. Who wouldn't take risks? Heads I win and tails you lose. Who would not take risks in that situation? So it leads to risky behavior, and in this context, risky behavior means loading the portfolio companies up with excessive amounts of debt. So that is where we are in terms of what's going on, and this analysis is what drives a lot of our proposals for this is what we want to rein in, right? This excessive use of debt, this excessive putting companies at risk, this excessive tax benefits that you're getting from all of this, without shutting down the private equity model. If they want to come in and do what they advertise that they do, save distressed companies, come in and improve the operations of healthy companies, that would be great. I see that I don't really have time to tell you about the employment effects or about employment relations. In the question and answer, I'll be happy to deal with that. But in my few remaining minutes, I think what I will do is jump ahead to the policy so you can see where I think we ought to be going with this. Let me talk about policy recommendations. One of our policy recommendations is that we need to increase transparency. If I had had the time, I would have told you publicly traded companies have to provide a ton of information that allows investors to know what's happening and allows researchers to actually figure out how that company is doing. Outside analysts can figure out what's happening. Private equity is private. There's no national database of anything. They don't have to tell you what they paid for a company. They don't have to tell you how much debt it has. In fact, they don't have to tell you that they bought the company. Unions often do not know that the company whose workers they represent is owned by private equity until the private equity firm closes it down without the WARN Act or gets out of its pension liabilities in one way or another. And that's the first that they find out that the real owner of this company was a private equity firm. So we need to increase transparency. It is important to the limited partners who make the investment. It's important for the creditors who lend the money. And it's important for the workers. Before 2010, there were absolutely no reporting requirements for private equity. Dodd-Frank passed in 2010, and now we do have some minimal reporting requirements. After the financial crisis in Europe, they also implemented reporting requirements. They were far more stringent than ours. We need better reporting requirements. We need to limit the incentives for risky behavior, this taking the 20% and putting up only 2%. We need to end the preferential tax treatment, which multiplies the effects of the compensation scheme. We need to reduce the incentives for excessive use of debt. Really, an economist will tell you that there's no good reason to treat the interest on debt differently than dividends on equity from the point of view of any economic argument that you could make. So either we should reduce that or we should get rid of it, but we need to think about it. There are other ways of limiting it. So one of the things that has happened is that the Fed, as the ultimate regulator of the banks, has said in really a soft kind of regulation, here are some guidelines. If you give out leveraged loans that are so big that there is no possibility that this company, no reasonable expectation the company can pay it back, we're going to look at you very carefully. You're going to have to tell us why you did that. And that has, in fact, stopped them from giving out, some banks at least, from giving out these huge loans. We can reduce the incentives for asset stripping. Our proposal is a prenuptial agreement. You buy the company, you think you'll do better by selling off the assets, fine. But if the company goes bankrupt in 10 years because you sold off the assets, you have to make good. So prenuptial agreements. Eliminate the dividend payments in the first 2 years. No company should be putting on more debt, just loaded up with debt, should be putting on more debt in the first 2 years. You have no way of knowing how this company is doing and no justification for that. And then workers are not protected because we look at these as investors, not as employers. And so they can tell some manager to close down a plant without giving the 60 days notice that you need under the WARN Act, and the manager and the private equity firm says, we're not responsible, we're just investors. You can require that they pay severance pay to workers in bankruptcy cases. It's nothing to go bankrupt and get rid of your workers. It's nothing to lay them off in this country. Unless they're executives, they don't get any severance pay or minimal severance pay. if you had to pay them. After all, you bought that company because they built that company. They have a lot of sweat equity in that company. If you're going to downsize them or you're going to close the plant or whatever it is, they should be rewarded for that investment which they made. So we need severance pay. And we need to close the loopholes that let private equity get out of its pension liabilities when it declares bankruptcy. So I think I will stop here as I'm just about out of time, but I thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour and a recorded talk by economist Eileen Applebaum, author of the book Private Equity at Work: When Wall Street Manages Main Street. You can find a link to more information about her book on our website. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics, the Department of Economics at the University of Utah, and KCPW. You can hear this program again and other podcasts on KCPW's website, and join us every Wednesday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCPW.